put on some music, waited, waited, and nothing. Absolutely nothing. I was like, oh no, what's going to happen? So I waited for 15 minutes during my set of music that I was playing, and nobody called. And I said, okay. So I went back and I tried to re-explain the puzzle in a different way. I was like, okay, now here's the idea of what you're doing. And put the music on, read the phone number, put the music on. Again, waited and waited. Nothing happened. In the third round, my computer science professor called in. He was like my ringer in the audience. And he was like, oh, you know, Beth, I think what you really need to do is explain this aspect of the puzzle. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I went on again and did the puzzle all over again, explaining it a third way. And during the next 15 minutes, actually, one of my friends called in and could answer the puzzle. So I was so devastated when no one tried to answer my puzzle the first two times. I was like, what am I doing wrong? Is no one listening? Am I just speaking into a vacuum here? But I realized from this a couple of things. First of all, I can't be both click and clack at once. I think that what makes click and clack magical, and what ended up being magic for me in my show, was a sense of dialogue, okay? So the fact that click and clack explain and ask questions live on air is what makes those puzzles something that people can really get their heads around. So what I did from going forward there was I brought in my producer, the head of the radio station, to come in and be the clack to my click. And we would go over the puzzles, and he would ask questions whether he needed to know the answers or not, just wherever he thought that it would sort of fill in some more interesting information. And from then on, my puzzles were magical, except for the ones that I screwed up because I didn't think about the answer hard enough ahead of time.
you learned something very useful there. Mm-hmm. You learned something different than what I would have learned. I would have just learned always have a plant in the audience.
That is also useful.
You text friend, like, I need you to call right now. Just here's the answer. Just call, please.
Yeah. So what I did is I sort of brought my plant into the studio with me. Right? Yeah. So they could be right there.
Well, thank you very much. Dana?
Let me introduce myself, because I actually wasn't scheduled to be on this panel, but Samuel needed a pinch hitter, and so I agreed to do it.
And thank you so much for doing it.
Anyway, so my name is Dana McKenzie, and my wife doesn't like me when I say this, but I'm a former mathematician. She says, you're still a mathematician. Anyway, I now work as a freelance writer. I've been doing that for about 20 years. And I think when I'm on a panel with Samuel and Beth, I feel a little bit like a dinosaur, because I still do the written kind of communication. And I think in this day and age, there's so much with vlogs and so forth that is exciting. And I'm sort of not into that generation, I'm afraid. I'm a writer, and I write mostly for popular science type magazines. And I've also written a couple books. And mathematicians might know me best for the series What's Happening in the Mathematical Sciences, which is put out by the AMS. So I've written the last four of those. So Samuel asked for this, for an anecdote about a failure to communicate. So as I said, I used to be a math professor, and around 20 years ago, I had sort of a midlife crisis and decided that what I really wanted to do was be a writer. And I found out about a wonderful program at the University of California at Santa Cruz called the Science Communication Program, which takes people with a science background, with a science degree, and teaches them journalism so that they can then become writers or radio producers or whatever. So I was so ecstatic when I learned about this program, because I just couldn't believe that something like that existed, that you could actually take courses and learn to be a journalist. So the story I wanted to tell is of something that happened that year. At this point, so I was still very much, I was learning journalism, and I was still very much in an academic, mathematical mindset. And we took a semester of news writing, where we learned how to write for newspapers. And then we got to a semester of magazine writing. And one of the things that we covered in that semester is how to pitch an article. So I was really excited. I was really jazzed about this, because in the news semester, we weren't really able to do all that much science or math. It was learning actually how to do news stories, crime and politics, stuff like that. But now we were really doing science. And so I really wanted to do my first math story. And as a mathematician, my big interest was geometry. And so I thought, okay, hot diggity dog, I'll do a story about hyperbolic geometry, one of my favorite subjects. And so I wrote out this, you know, query for an article I would write about hyperbolic geometry and turned it into the professor. And I still remember him reading this thing and sort of these furrows on his eyebrows getting deeper and deeper, you know, and he's, you know, rubbing his head, trying to make any sense of what I wrote, because there was nothing there that was English as far as he could tell. So, and I learned a great lesson from that. Of course, you know, the pitch didn't fly, and I ended up writing about something else. But what I learned was that, well, first of all, there's a huge language barrier between mathematicians and the rest of the world. And also, this was something I learned throughout this year, that when you're writing articles for the public, you want to think about telling stories. That's the way people learn, and it's how you engage people. And if you want to write about mathematics, you embed it in a story. Journalists actually don't usually talk about writing articles. They talk about writing stories. They say, I wrote a story about this today, and so forth. And I think that the word is not accidental. Almost any article you'll see in the popular media is at heart a story. And that means it has people in it, and it means it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so the principles that you use for telling a story are the principles you use for writing the article. And it may be that the article, I mean, ideally the article will involve some mathematics. It may just be about a mathematician. That's a great way to write an article. And I think that's probably a lot of what you're doing on your podcast. You know, you just find an interesting mathematician, get him to tell his story, and there's your article or there's your podcast. But people, ordinary people outside mathematics, relate to people. Now, they won't relate to the mathematics unless you show them the person. So that to me was the big lesson. And so when I pitched this article on hyperbolic geometry, I was just thinking about hyperbolic geometry. You know, that's the way I describe it to a mathematician. But, you know, for writing for the public, I had to think about what story do I want to tell. So to sort of give an ending to this story, because stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. I finally did get to write my hyperbolic geometry article. It was years later, like about 16 years later, and there's actually a chapter for a book.
Thank you, Damon. Colin?
Okay, so I'm Colin Adams. I teach at Williams College, where I've been for a long time. And before I ever wanted to be a mathematician, I wanted to be a writer. I'll just give you a little bit of history. So I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid, but I ended up going to MIT as an undergraduate, and they're really not focused on writing, they're focused on, you know, other things. And when I was at MIT, I fell in love with mathematics. And so I kind of gave up on the writing and I started doing the mathematics. And then I got to Williams College, and I as a hobby, I started writing again. And I actually published my first story in the Williams Literary Review, which was really for undergraduates, but they let me publish something in there. And that was my first publication. And then I realized that I could do writing about mathematics, but my take on writing about mathematics was humor in mathematics. And so I started doing sort of humorous math writing. And I took some of those articles to Ina Mete, who is one of the editors at the time, was one of the editors for Springer. She's now at AMS. And I said, could I publish a book out of these? And she said, a book? No. Why don't you do a column in the Mathematical Intelligencer? And the Mathematical Intelligencer comes out 4 times a year. And so they gave me a column in the Mathematical Intelligencer. And so for over the last, you know, I don't know, must be about 15 years now, I have to come up with 4 stories a year for the Mathematical Intelligencer. And so I've been producing those stories. I turn them into theater. And I don't know if any of you got a chance to go to the theater we put on last night. So at the joint math meetings every night, every time we put on math theater, and it's usually based on those columns. And then I've been writing a bunch of books. I have about 9 books out. One of them is a comic book about knot theory called Why Not with an attached toy. There's another one, which is a compendium of those stories. There's a novel. My most recent one was a novel called Zombies in Calculus. I'm working on a second novel, not on zombies, on something else. And so it's fun to do those things. And then my wife was an actress, and I used to sit on her opening nights, and I'd see her doing her thing. And I'd just sit there and I think, okay, how could I use acting to do math, to present math? And I always love this idea of thinking about how do you get people to listen long enough to see the beauty of the mathematics involved? And so that was always kind of the goal, is to think about unusual ways to do that. So I created this character, Mel Slugbait. And Mel Slugbait is a real estate agent from Texas, and he wears a green plaid suit and has a Texas accent and a green plaid tie and cowboy boots. And this was when I did not have tenure, by the way. And so for the first time I ever did it at Williams, for Colloquium at Williams, and I really was not sure if this would be the end of my career. You know, if they'd watch this and say, okay, we are not gonna give this guy tenure. But luckily, it went well, and so it worked out fine, and they liked it, and it was fun to do. And then I started getting invitations, and it turned out, it really sort of scared me in my career when Mel Slugbait started getting more invitations to speak than I did, you know, and it sort of grew. And the trick here is, I gotta tell you, this is a trick for life, actually, is find a niche no one else is in, okay? And so for me, it turned out to be math humor. There was very little competition in math humor. My biggest competition was Ed Berger, and he had the office next to mine. So it was like, you know, and so it was a good situation to be in. So I got a lot of invitations. So anyway, the story I'm going to tell about my failure was one of those invitations. So I got an invitation to speak as Mel Slugbait, and it was from a school in California. And so they flew me out, and so I flew out on a Thursday, you know, and I had to get someone to teach my classes for me, you know, a 6-hour flight, got to California, put me up for the night. The next day comes, and it's time for the talk, and it's a giant auditorium, huge auditorium, and I've got my, you know, silly suit on, you know, and I got all dressed already, and I come out, and there are 3 people in the audience, and they're all spread out over this giant auditorium, you know? And the thing is, if you're gonna act like an idiot, you can get away with it if there's enough people in the audience that there are people that are seed people who are laughing, you know? And then they help the other people laugh and the other people to sort of appreciate the joke. But when there's 3 people in the room, nobody laughs, and then you feel like an idiot, and then you act like an idiot. And so the whole thing was just, you know, I'm going through the thing, but I'm like embarrassed to be doing it. And it was just a complete disaster. And then I had to spend another day there before my flight went back. And so it was a huge amount of effort on my part. And it was just a complete disaster. And so I don't exactly know what the lesson is, other than you sort of maybe should communicate with people to make sure that you're not gonna find yourself in that situation. Because you don't really have control of the audience and what they're doing to get an audience there. And so that's kind of the risk you run. But I strongly urge, I mean, the thing that I've really enjoyed about doing this, I strongly urge, do stuff, just do weird stuff, you know, get out there, because it's hard for people to sit through traditional